Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa, the center of it all, more or less. And this is Community Radio, and we're glad it is. Well, trees. We share the planet with an amazing and indispensable species. They shelter us. They feed us. They breathe for us. Forests have a major role in holding this planet together. For too long, we've taken them for granted. Forests are in trouble. Is there anything we can do? Today, we're going to talk about trees. We welcome Hannah Lewis. Welcome, Hannah, to our kitchen table.
Thank you. It's great to be here with you guys.
Good. And she's here because she has a lot to say about trees. She's written a book called The Mini Forest Revolution, Using the Miyawaki Method to Rapidly Rewild the World. I like the rapidly rewild the world part. Once you can get your tongue around that, that's good. Hannah is the editor of Compendium of Scientific and Practical Findings Supporting Eco-Restoration to Address Global Warming, published by Biodiversity for a Living Climate, Livable Climate, a nonprofit environmental organization based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's worked in various roles, working on sustainable food systems, including the Midwest Regional Director for National Center for Appropriate Technology. She has degrees in sustainable agriculture and environmental studies from Iowa State University and Middlebury College. And she wrote this book that we're going to be talking about today, The Mini Forest Revolution. She wrote it when she was living in France with her partner and their two children. So we want to find out why this book happened and what this book is about. Let's see. Tell us about what this book is about and how you came to tell this story, Hannah. And you take over.
Yeah. Well, let's see. You mentioned a lot of the things that led up to writing this book. So my job with Biodiversity for a Livable Climate is to read about the importance of ecosystems in terms of regulating climate cycles and nutrient cycles, carbon cycles, and keeping temperatures cool. And so I was thinking about those things a lot when I was living in France, because my partner is French, and so we were there for about 5.5 years. And a story came across my screen about a couple in the nearby city of Nantes. We were in the region of Brittany, and the couple had decided to plant a small native forest, dense native forest, sort of in response to a road expansion that was happening near their home. And what struck me about it was that it was a couple that was doing this. They were just doing it with, you know, a team of volunteers. So, you know, it was something that a small group of people could do, and it seemed really ecologically meaningful to plant not just trees individually, but a forest, an ecosystem that would sustain itself.
Can you tell us what the difference between a forest and trees are?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, normally when we look at landscaping in parks and yards and anywhere, we see trees planted as magnificent, beautiful individuals. You can see their silhouettes. They're just this wonderful, beautiful thing. But they're planted, yeah, as individuals in isolation, more or less from other species, from other plant species. And so with this method, the Miyawaki method that you mentioned, that I observed in this couple from Nantes that had planted a small forest, what they were doing was planting, you know, 20 to 30 different species, and not just tall canopy trees, but also mid-sized trees and shrubs to make up the layers of a natural forest. And then they were planting them close together, and it would stimulate interactions between the plants and with the soil microorganisms, So the idea of this method is that you plant all of these plants in the way that they would have, the way they would grow, maybe for instance in a clearing of a forest. You would have multiple species seeds dropping down, and they would be dropping randomly and close together, and then they would grow up quickly to fill any opening in the canopy. So that's what you're recreating, more or less. Yeah.
Well, so they have, it's very complicated. Your book makes it very clear that this particular method and the rationale behind it is not just you go out willy-nilly and plant a lot of trees. It's about biodiversity and recreating, well... It's sort of looks complicated, but talk about the climax forest and the big shade tolerant trees and what happens in the successions, and explain us the Miyawaki method.
Okay. So Miyawaki method is named for a Japanese botanist named Akira Miyawaki, who lived from 1929 to just last year he passed away. And he studied weeds, he studied plant ecology, he studied plant communities, how plants grow together. And so when he developed this method, what he wanted to do was recreate sort of the strongest, ecologically most robust vegetation that would be growing on any piece of land had it not been developed for agriculture or cities or anything else. If the land was just there doing its thing, what would be growing there? And that, so what he looked at to figure that out was the idea of equal success. So I think we've all seen this in various stages. When you have bare ground and you just leave it alone for a few years, you see dandelions and clover and all sorts of, you know, little grasses and stuff shooting up on that land. So you get smaller, short-lived plants at the beginning. And those plants protect the soil. They hold moisture a little bit. They add organic material. And they... So they're improving the conditions little by little, and over time you get bigger, longer-living plants that are attracted to those better conditions, that can grow better in those conditions. And so then eventually you get pioneer trees like poplars or birch that grow pretty quickly and don't live as long as species such as oak, for example. And they also need a lot of sun. And so... Then you get species that are shade tolerant and even longer living and slower growing. And those are the climax species. So, they then grow up in the shade of those earlier successional species. And then they eventually take over the canopy, and they're shade tolerant. So their seeds can drop and germinate in the ground below them, but none of the other species that have come before that need lots of sun can. So those earlier successional species will be growing around the edge of the forest, and the climax trees will just continue to perpetuate in that space because they're shade tolerant and they can continue. They can germinate and grow in the thick shade of that canopy. So it creates kind of like a stable biological community that's not going to change much over time. It's going to stay. And so that's what Miyawaki was trying to create, was sort of a relatively stable plant forest community that would, you know, that would be strong and would resist outside stresses and heat. And last, he said sometimes when he was sort of giving his presentation about the idea, he would say, this will last until 9,000 years, until the next ice age. Not the individuals that they planted, but those species would perpetuate that long.
So the forest knows what it's doing very much, except we've kind of over-helped ourselves to the forest. This is not a tree plantation. This is an ecosystem. This is pretty amazing, and it's I really enjoyed this book.
Yeah, Hannah. You know, Lana and I both read a lot of environmental literature and books, and you know what's coming on and all of that. And usually it's very depressing. And we often talk about the bummer news, but this book was like a breath of fresh air because it describes a lot of things that we intuitively know or maybe haven't even thought about, and it gives us something to do about it. I'm going to do a couple of quotes in here. It says, to most of us, the landscape into which we're born looks perfectly normal, as though it has always looked more or less that way. And then you talk about the fact that large parts of the planet were once heavily, heavily, heavily forested, and we have lost a lot of that. And not only have we lost the forests, but that even forests that have grown back are not the original species that thrived for thousands of years in those areas. So part of the Miyawaki method is to try to determine historically what the native vegetation really looked like, because those are the plants that will do the best in that growing situation. Now, as you can see from reading the book, you talk about many different places. Each part of the planet has its own unique climate condition, you know, the temperatures, the highs, the lows, the humidity, the soil types. And actually determining what those plants are that should be put into the forest, it's like a historical resuscitation or something. And in the book, you talk about the different ways that some of these things are determined. Can you describe different ways that people have to look for the evidence of what was the original native habitat of whatever ecological niche one would want to build a forest into?
Yeah. Well, the way Miyawaki discovered it in Japan was he noticed that the Shinto shrines, they're forests, and in the Shinto religion, there's a shrine associated with a small forest, and these are located throughout the country. And so back Shinto's been around for a few thousand years, and when towns and cities were being established, they always left a little bit of forest to house the gods, and that was the Shinto shrine forest. And so that was sacred, and people were not allowed to cut any trees from there or to damage the forest anyway, because it was the home of the gods. And so what he noticed was that the vegetation in those shrine forests was different. Like in the greater Tokyo region, he saw that growing in those forests, you had oaks and laurels and these, you know, broadleaf trees and evergreen trees that stayed green in winter, whereas in much of the area around them, you had deciduous species and a lot of pines planted. And so it was just different. And so he started to think about that and realized that actually in that area in southern Japan, the temperatures, the climate is suitable for evergreen vegetation, for broadleaf trees like evergreen oaks and laurels that hold their leaves all through the winter and don't drop off because the temperatures never get too low for them to drop off. Whereas in northern Japan, they have deciduous species like we have here, so that it does get cold and the trees do need to drop their leaves in the winter. So he thought, well, actually that makes sense. Those Shinto shrines in the Tokyo area, they have evergreen species, and that is the type of tree that's adapted to this climate. So why are they only there and not elsewhere? And so what he established was that most of the other trees planted in that area were planted. They were planted. They were brought in from different areas because people liked the looks of them, or they were secondary forests kind of growing in. But then he saw the successional process happening because he would see the evergreen species growing as seedlings in the shade of those secondary forests. So basically this is true in many places. And I've been interested to read that actually Europe, all of Europe is climatic forest region, but in the area where I was living, Brittany, it's been dedicated to agriculture for thousands of years, and so there's no really living memory of the forest having been there. But climatically, that's what, if it were left alone, it would go right back to forest. But it's hard, but since those species have been gone and a lot of others have been brought in because, like, we had a lot of palm trees in our town, and because they do survive there, but they're not native. So
palm trees,
they don't look native either when you're there.
Right. But yeah, so what Miyawaki recommends is like, we don't have shrine forests, we don't have sacred forests everywhere. So it was useful in Japan, and he would survey those forests. And then for any of his planting projects, he would survey the nearest shrine forest to figure out what species to plant in the forest that he was planting. And so here we can look for, older remnants of forest, and we can see what trees are growing well. And like, for instance, the departments of natural resources do typically have long list, and botanical societies do know what the native trees are. But I think what's interesting about the Miyawaki method is that you're planting a whole community of trees together. So like, if you had kind of wetter soils near a river, then you would plant a particular community of trees that tolerate those wetter conditions there. Whereas in a more well-drained area, you would have a different group of forest species, so those would be the ones you would be looking for. So you're really, every time you're looking for a community of plants that are particularly suited to the climatic conditions and the soil conditions of wherever you're planting. So it's not, you need to be careful figuring it out, but the information is out there, and so I think it helps to get a good team together of people, you know, who associated with the DNR or universities or botanical societies who have an idea of what types of vegetation grow naturally in what places.
Well, for example, in the book you talk about when you were living in Roscoff, which is out in Brittany, which is very coastal, rocky, beautiful shoreline. The spot that you finally picked in your community where you did this, was it right on the shore?
It was close to the shore. It was like in a little kind of a little gentle kind of elevated area or cliff, not too far from the shore. So yeah, so we had to think about exposure to wind and to salt spray and which species would tolerate that. And we reached out to help from the National Botanical Conservatory Breast, which is in our region, and they looked at the site. I sent them the GPS coordinates, and they said, okay, that's the site. That's helpful. Well, here are some studies that have been done in similar sites on the Brittany Coast near where your site is, and they have similar conditions. And when scientists surveyed those forests, here's the species that they found. And so we planted those species that had already been found in similar sites growing naturally.
How big is space when you're talking about a mini forest? What is a mini forest?
Yeah, the size that we planted and that's planted most often in kind of a new wave of projects that have been happening all over the world in the past 5 years or so is, you know, about 200 square yards, which is roughly the size of a tennis court.
That's small. That's
exactly.
It's amazing.
But it does work in larger areas also.
Yeah. I mean, Milwaukee did, I think some of his larger projects were like 30 hectares, which is about 80 acres, roughly. So yeah, he did, but that, since you're planting really densely, that takes a lot of people volunteering to help put plants in the ground.
That it sounds really daunting. I garden. I love gardening, but trees and forests, I've often thought they're so big. They know so much more than I do. How can you plant a forest? It's just amazing. And I understand just from reading this book that one of understanding the local species is really, really important because, as you said, things do want to grow. And if they are in the right place, that's good. And gardening and taking gardening skills, we'll take a little break here, but we'll come back and talk more about how this stuff gets in the ground. And there are people, there are communities that are involved in doing this, which I think is just one of the most exciting things about this method. But first, I want to remind folks that this is KHOI. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. And this is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Hannah Lewis and about her new book called The Mini Forest Revolution, Using the Miyawaki Method to Rapidly Rewild the World. What a good idea. You mentioned that mini forests really can be mini, small, but you have case studies in this book. And
from all over the globe.
All over the world. So we're talking about forests that can happen in an arid region, in a dense urban region, in a windswept, as you mentioned, a windswept coastal region. How do these, and one of the things that I noticed is that there's usually community involvement. People, there's hands-on, there's community ownership of these projects. Tell us how that works, Hannah.
Maybe I'll just back up a little bit in sort of the evolution of the method or its growing popularity around the world, mm-hmm. And say that Dr. Miyawaki, he always worked with lots of people in the planting process. So he worked with ministries, you know, government ministries, cities, schools, universities, and then he also worked with companies. And so he would organize large planting days with hundreds or even thousands of people that would come, and it would obviously have to be super organized. But the idea was to have people experience the planting process, be part of the regeneration of a piece of land, and also to understand something about it. So he always led a planting festival with what he called a naming ceremony. So the whole group, they would always line up the tree species, like the little sapling, and then a picture of the mature tree it would become, on some tables. And then they would take the main tree species. So the main oak that they were going to be planting that would, really be a huge member of the forest community. And so they would name a few of them. So one person would hold up the sapling and say the name of it and the specific name. So not just oak, but white oak or fir oak or whatever it is. And then everybody would repeat the name. So the idea was to like really have people thinking about what the species were that they were going to be planting. So Miyawaki, he was working with a lot of Japanese companies they did this all over Japan, but then some of those companies had overseas facilities. So that took them to the U.S., to Turkey, to China, to South America, and to India. And in India in 2009, he planted, at an auto manufacturing facility in Bangalore. And there was an engineer there named Shubhendu Sharma who volunteered to plant for the planting festival and really became completely fascinated with this, as many people have. And so he started studying the method. Miyawaki wrote a book actually called The Healing Power of Forest, which so Shubhendu read that. He planted a forest in his own backyard, and he saw 10 new bird species that he had never seen before show up in his backyard after having planted several months after having planted. So he just became more and more fascinated and eventually decided to quit his job, which he had loved. But he said, this is something everybody should know. This way of planting forests that's so ecologically sound. So he started his own forest planting company, and then eventually he gave a talk online that went viral, and people all over Europe and all over the world saw it, and that really sparked a whole new wave of interest in the Miyawaki method. And so I wanted to say that because this new wave of people planting forests. So for instance, one of the people that saw that video was a young Dutch man named Stan Bleichrot. And he had been leading, he worked for a nature education organization that had lots of a large volunteer network. And he had been thinking, a lot of these kids, the Netherlands is a really urban city a really urban country. And a lot of the, you know, kids living in cities don't get to go out and experience nature. And so he thought, well, is there any way we can bring nature to the kids since they don't necessarily get to leave the cities to go out into the woods? And then he saw Shubhendu's video and it clicked. He said, oh, wow, yeah, something the size of a tennis court or even smaller, that's bringing nature into the city, and kids can actually plant it. Because when you plant one of these mini forests, you're planting really small, you know, 1 year or 2 year old trees that are almost like a large tomato seedling. You know, if you, they're small and light, and you can dig a hole for it yourself with one hand and plant it. So, so the community aspect then in the Netherlands became one of always partnering with schools. And so every time they do this nature environment organization does a mini forest project, they work with a particular school. And so there's, by the end of this year, 2022, there will be, they will have planted 230 mini forests, in each one in collaboration with a school or a nursery school. And so in each case, it's the kids and the, you know, and the teachers or other parents that are planting the forest. And then it's the kids that are making sure that it's doing well. In the first 3 years, you need to make sure that you water it and that the weeds are not taking over. But then after that, the mini forest is self-sufficient. So the kids can help take care of it in the first 2 years, but then throughout, they're also, in the Netherlands, this program is also working with the teachers to train them in outdoor education so that teachers can lead classroom activities, not only in science, but, you know, literature or other things related to the forest out in that space. So that's like an example of a way a program has been built around this concept that's really deeply rooted in communities because it's attached to schools in every case.
Well, one thing we haven't really made clear, but you talk about it in the book, the point of these, of starting these forests in such a concentrated way is that a normal forest can take 100 to 200 years to become a climax forest. With the Miyake method, that can happen in 15 to 40 years. So you end up with mature forests much more quickly and sort of in our current environmental dismay. This time frame is much more doable and very encouraging. A few programs ago, we talked about the work of Diana Beresford Kroger and her book called The Global Forest. And it helps to clarify that, you know, large portions of the planet were originally forested and that, you know, we cut them down to build cathedrals and boats and, you know, all kinds of other things that...
Toilet paper.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we continue to do that. And, for example, in New Zealand, you go there, it's beautiful, you look around, it's all like lots of pastures with sheep and cows and then lots of trees growing. But if you look closely, you'll see that the trees are planted like every, it's rows. It looks like cornfields of trees. These are not the kinds of, this is not going to create a forest. Because those trees are harvested every 35 years, like any other crop. We are not talking about that kind of forest that, you know, yeah, it sequesters some carbon like, you know, like cornfields do. But you mentioned in the book that smaller, younger trees do not sequester anywhere near the amount of carbon that larger, older trees do. And, you know, the benefits of having old established forests and the networks and the soil holding capacities and there's so many qualities that that come when forests are planted thoughtfully using the Miyawaki method forces you to do that. You have to pick the appropriate species that can live together. You also talk a lot about one of the reasons that these forests grow so quickly and are so healthy is it takes a significant soil preparation. You want to discuss what the Miyawaki method requires for preparing the site.
Yeah, and also like the quickness, they're growing quickly, like 1 meter per year, which is a pretty good growth rate. But the also, like, the difference between the 100 years versus 10 to 20 years is also just the fact of skipping over the successional process. Mm-hmm. So you're skipping all of the earlier stages. So there's two different kind of fast growth rates, in a sense. The actual physical plants growing fast, and also the forest maturing fast because you've skipped over the successional stages, the middle ones, or all the earlier ones. So basically what you're doing is creating the ideal conditions for a forest to grow. So, often we're starting with, degraded or compacted soil. And so, what we do with this method is just decompact the soil, and then add organic material, and Miyawaki says 20 to 30 centimeters of topsoil needs to be there. So we're adding a lot of composted manure or anything to build up that organic matter.
Well, how deeply do you have to dig to get the decompaction?
Well, it depends on the level of compaction. But it's usually anywhere between 30 centimeters and a meter, which is about a yard deep. Mm-hmm. So that a meter would be the deepest, but it could be more shallow than that. So you decompact it and typically using a machine, which there's a lot of upfront effort that goes into it, and then adding all the organic material, and then you plant, you know, three plants per square meter, and then after that you need to protect the soil with mulch. So we're adding a lot of dry straw mulch on top. Like I don't know, I think about 4 to 5 pounds per square yard.
So how deep is that? Like 6 inches or?
It's about, I don't know, several inches deep. So you're protecting, because when you're planting, the little saplings that you're planting, they just look like little twigs. They're not creating any of their own shade yet. And so you need to protect the soil with the mulch. But so you're creating this ideal conditions, and then they're densely planted. So soon their leaves are going to start spreading out and forming a canopy that then covers up the soil, that shades the soil and protects it. And then they start creating their own litter, which will drop down and then nourish the soil. So you need to just give it that start with the thick mulch.
So in the very beginning, describe what you've dug up the ground down about 3 feet. You've put in more composted materials to enrich the soil. You've stuck your seedlings in at intervals of what, like a foot from each other, more or less?
It's about the length from the tip of your fingers to your elbow.
Okay, so 18 to 24 inches.
A cubit.
Yeah, a cubit. And then there just sticks in the ground. And that's what it looks like with the straw mulched over at the very beginning after it's been planted?
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't look very spectacular at the very beginning.
Okay, and then when do you start to notice changes? 6 months? Year.
Well, usually you're planting in the winter, so, you know, then the following summer you'll see everything green up with their little leaves, but they'll still look pretty small, and you know, the mulch will be fully visible. But in Paris, I remember they planted a forest like this on a grassy embankment next to the beltway that circles the city. And so I remember, like, the person in charge of that, his name was Enrico Fusto. He was telling me in the third year, he said, well, now I actually am starting to see the different layers of the forest, because you've got, you know, that's what we're trying to do in the first place. So we've got the taller species at the top, and you can see that there's like layers of vegetation all the way down to the shrubs at the bottom. And in the year before that, you had a nice kind of full canopy, but you weren't seeing the layers quite yet. But yeah, but if they're growing about 3 feet per year, then they're going to surpass us pretty quickly. And so the one I looked at when it was in Paris, when it was about 2.5 years old in the winter, yeah, the trees were already taller than me. It didn't look like a forest yet because the plants were still pretty small, but they were really filling out the space well and creating that canopy. And creating the canopy early is key because, as I mentioned, it's then going to shade the soil and protect the soil, and also create a microclimate within there. So it'll block the wind a little bit, block out some of the hot sun and some of the heat and dry air. And so that is also going to help the little ecosystem do well, that it's got that interior microclimate.
Well, this reminds me of a book which I have loved for a long time. It's by a French writer named Jean Giono, and it's called The Man Who Planted Trees. And it's basically a story set in the Provençal area of France, but it's like a Johnny Appleseed story. The guy is just going around sticking in a fairly deserted part of the country where no one wanted to live anymore. They weren't getting enough rainfall, and he goes around just methodically sticking the seeds into the soil, and eventually the trees come, and then eventually, because the trees are there, the rain comes. And then when the rain comes and the water comes and the people move back in and the families come, and it's like a whole repopulation thing just because of planting trees. So one of the things that one of the services, as they say, of a forest is cooling the soil, making, certainly making more oxygen in its respiration, and holding the moisture in the soil and the moisture in the atmosphere, which in desert regions is very, very crucial. You write in your book about several places in really arid lands where this method was applied.
Yeah, and so normally, so the idea really is that we're growing forests in places that are climatically suitable for a forest, or where the soil is suitable for the forest. So we're not trying to force a forest to grow in somewhere where it's not adapted. And this is sort of inherent in the method because we are planting native species. So. But in that place, in Rajasthan, India, is a semi-arid area. But the project there was right between two rivers, kind of where they come together. So it was more of a riparian area, and that allowed him to work with the water that was there. I think it would have been harder elsewhere, but he found. He got the water to divert into a pond, and then that pond was torn up, kind of a source of groundwater that would seep out to where the plants were. So after the monsoon season had come and left a lot of water in the pond, then he could plant. So another thing he observed was that in that area, the forest doesn't look like it does in the more humid parts of India, where it's really dense what he observed in the Rajasthan area was that the trees and associated species were growing in clusters. And so he planted in clusters that were kind of spaced out from each other. So there would be a tree, and then there would be a lot of shrubs around the tree, and the shrubs were important because they would hold the moisture for the tree. So so he was still using that idea of a plant community, of plants working together to kind of hold the moisture in the area and support each other in various ways, but modeling it after that, the way vegetation grows in that particular area.
This actually, we're trying to understand how forests work, and then when we do it ourselves, we realize, my goodness, this is a lot of work.
And very complex.
And especially, it is like a garden. We are nurturing things back to life, and I can't think of a better time where it's more important. I mean, who doesn't like trees? But another, your book kind of goes around to all these different places that this has happened, and talks a lot about how people react to what's happening. And even in your experience in your community in France, of course, the first reaction of the local authorities, oh, we can't do that. What? You know, it takes people time to realize that, well, what trees are for, what they're worth, and that's kind of one of the most fascinating things about this, how people get involved in this, because it takes a village to make a forest, because doing it this way and speeding up time, it's good. Do you have anything to say about how people react to having a mini forest in their community?
I think that they were perplexed at first. They thought, why would we have a forest in a city? Traditionally, they've always been separate. But that's why the idea mini forest is kind of important. So I think, it's kind of getting harder and harder to ignore the news about climate change and biodiversity loss. So I think that is filtering in a little bit. And one thing we did in Rostov, since we were working with the schools, was the schools were the ones that named the forest. They were the ones that planted the forest. And we're encouraging the teachers to take the kids out there and do lessons in the forest. And so also to kind of like contextualize the project one thing we did was to organize the screening of a couple movies, and one of them was by a French, with the kids, it was by a French person who had spent his whole life studying forests, and so he did this wonderful movie that just basically explains how a forest works and how much symbiosis there is between the species in the forest, and how every creature depends on that web of other creatures, animals, plants, microorganisms, and so it really, really elevated, you know, I think for the kids and for the community as a whole, why forests matter and what's so beautiful about them and so important about them. But I think doing the planting project kind of created a space for us to open that conversation and talk about those things, and to basically, you know, as a way to explain why the heck we're doing this project here. I think it clicks more in some places than others. For instance, in Rostov, we didn't have the argument about cooling, because it's already a very cool place to discuss the ocean, you know, the breeze from the ocean all the time. So it's actually always cool. But in a place like Paris, they've had hotter and hotter days and hotter spells through the summer. And so actually heat is becoming a really serious issue in Paris, like in many other cities, especially. And so the idea then addresses a very real concern people have. You know, trees cool the air, cool the space around them, and trees growing together, you know, multiplies the impact, but also allows the trees to to thrive better, to grow better, because they're growing in a in an ecosystem which is providing lots of other benefits to them. So so it's sort of amplifying the benefits that any one tree could have.
Yeah, I think we're kind of noticing that maybe trees might be a good idea. That they and it seems like
yes, they have services to offer.
Yeah,
right?
the services. Oh goodness. Yeah, the climate is doing some things to our awareness, and it's
and part
it's
of
amazing.
The problem is that we have lost large percents of our global forests, which changes. I mean, it's not just that the cars are spewing carbon into the air. It's also that we have changed the actual vegetation on the planet significantly. Can we bring this back for a moment to Iowa? Now, Iowa is not naturally forested. It is a prairie system with, well, for example, bur oak savannas were common. And I've been walking at Ada Hayden lately where they have a bur oak stand, and they are magnificent trees. So what kinds of, how does the Milwaukee method sort of fit into prairie restoration and that sort of thing that you know goes on in Iowa?
Right. Well, I think one place is along riparian areas. There's more water in there, those areas, and typically they are wooded.
That would be your oak savannas then.
Using this method that would be really interesting. And I had this question. I actually asked a specific question about Iowa to Lee Frelick, who is the director of the University of Minnesota Center for Forest Ecology. And he said, climatically, Iowa is also suitable for forests, because a lot of the prairie there was maintained as prairie through burning. But climatically speaking, it can support forests. So
especially the eastern part of the state, yeah.
More in the eastern, yeah, more so in the eastern part. But if you were going to do a project in a city, I think it could work, but it would be worth a conversation with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and other university folks who are really, really familiar with the ecology to figure out what the species mix should be.
So we have spaces in Iowa. We certainly know trees can grow here, and we just have to learn to live with our environment a little differently. Our cities are full of these things called parks and lawns, and we have this need to mow underneath all the trees. I think it's going to take a little changing in our species to think about that, because there is a power that comes from a forest, and a power doesn't necessarily come from a lawn. I don't know. I've never felt all that. I want to thank you for writing this book. This is just a dandy book, Hannah. I want to I'd like to read a little bit here. The foreword to your book is written by Paul Hawken. And here's what Paul Hawken says about your book. Hannah Lewis describes a gift to the despairing world. There may be no single climate solution that has greater breadth of benefit than mini forests. And that's not a small thing. I think that's pretty darn good. So, good. The book is The Mini Forest Revolution, Using the Milwaukee Method to Rapidly Rewild the World by Hannah Lewis. It's a good book.
Chelsea Green publication, so it shouldn't be too hard to find.
Chelsea Green Publications. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. This is KHOI Community Radio. We come to you every Tuesday at noon and repeated 7 o'clock in the evening or any time at www.khoifm.org. Music by the Barn Owl Band. Let's think more about forests. We are all in this together. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.